Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Roberta J. M. Olson. She is curator of drawings emerita at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College. And we're continuing our conversation about her new book, Audubon as Artist, A New Look at the Birds of America. Roberta, welcome back to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
It's always wonderful to talk to you, Mark. Thank you so much for inviting me.
What I love about this book is that it is really from an art and artistic perspective. And I had never read a book about Audubon that really definitely had somebody who knew art and could include that information. Because it really, for me, my bottom line, that my big takeaway is that he was an artist of his time. He was an artist among other romantic artists, and he was affected and included sort of his influences in his works.
Yes, and he was affected not only by artists of his time and romantic artists, but also neoclassical artists.
Yeah.
And also the old masters, which was very important, but he is also a person of his time in terms of science, and I think it's really important as a historian that everyone realizes that what people do is a function of their times, and you have to evaluate them according to that. But he realized that, and he wanted to become an artist, and he set himself out to do that. And in terms of my process, because there was such a terra incognita, if I may say that, a desert in terms of serious examination of his works. People always just cited one thing, David's Napoleon Crossing the Alps, which is fairly important, but always simplistically, not with the layers that one can apply to it. I really had to do such incredible research, which is really sort of two decades of it.
Wow.
Compiling it, because I had to go back and say, what is he looking at?
Right.
What could he have seen? And the only way to do that is you have to, and this is the problem, you have to read his diaries, and there is only one that really is totally complete about his process, which is the Diary of 1826, the Diary of the Voyage. And if you read it seriously, you begin to see that he was much more educated in art, the old masters as well as current artists, and he always made sure, like he did with scientists, that he tried to keep current, even though he was this peripatetic person who didn't have a database, he didn't have an assistant, he didn't have an office, and he tried to do what he could. But for me, it was really detective work, and I, of course, have read detective stories from childhood, but you really had to piece it together, and then you have to weigh everything. Am I correct in seeing this? What else goes into the mix? And so it was like putting together things, and a really good example, I think, is the one about Benjamin West, mm-hmm. The battle scene that which was the sort of prototype, and we know he copied the watercolor for the Red-Tailed Hawk and Bob White's. And no one has said this before. And the other one is a wonderful one, known only in his copy by his brothers, Edwin Landseer's, called Taking of the Buck. It's a hunting scene, a hunt scene. And he describes it in a later journal. And no one had ever allied what he was talking about with an actual work. And so that's what I tried to do. I tried to always say, what would he have seen? What does he describe that was either in Edinburgh or London or Paris? Or what does he see in Philadelphia or New York? Because it's important to be, shall we say, very honest, but also to be inventive and to not just look at things on the surface. You have to dig. You have to say, what was available to him? What does he allude to? So it was, you know, it was an adventure. And it continues, because actually if I would have done it more, and we had limitations for this book, only a certain amount of words and a certain amount of illustrations, I could have easily written to give the reader a real sense of what he was seeing in terms of architecture, in terms of other scientists' work. In terms of art, it would take 3 volumes, literally. I mean, seriously, if not more.
Until
1839.
Yeah, but Roberta, you do a good job of including reproductions of works that he was influenced by. For instance, and I'm going to talk about an example. Early on in his career, he did a Purple Martin, a pastel and graphite. Mm-hmm. And you make the connections to Jean-Baptiste Doudray. Can you talk about that? Because that was a really, I never would have thought of that.
Doudray, and I should tell you this, that there is an exhibition called Doudray Mania on in Chantilly at the Musée Condé. And I contributed an essay to the catalog about that. Doudray was very important. He was one of the first naturalist artists who was doing something that Audubon was doing in terms of having settings for many of his works and also studying both mammals and birds in menageries. He was very involved with specific scientific descriptions, visual scientific descriptions. And Audubon certainly would have been exposed to his work. And they also had something else in common, because Doudray illustrated one of the most famous editions of the fables of La Fontaine. And we know that Audubon treasured La Fontaine. In fact, it was one of two books he always carried with him, beginning, we know, of his confessions in even before 1820. He talks about when he first came to Mill Grove in 1803, how he was reading La Fontaine. And their fables, which, again, Doudray illustrated, which are sort of moralizing tales, and they use animals to tell the tales in a very satirical, moralizing way. So they had that in common, and there's an incredible link between them. And in both cases, the involvement with La Fontaine encouraged the fact that they wanted to tell stories, or not stories in the sense of fiction, but to narrate things. Like Audubon wanted to tell the life story of the bird. That's what he called the ornithological biography, a biography of the bird. He wanted to imply in his watercolors, like Doudray did in his paintings, a kind of life cycle and also the behavior of the bird. Okay, and Audubon stated he wanted to do, of course he couldn't do it in every illustration because it's an impossible thing. He aimed, and he knew he would fail, to do the life story and do the sexes, the plumages, the ages, juveniles, mature individuals of the species. And it was his aim to try to do this. And Doudray had a similar mentality, which is very, very interesting. And there in the book, I begin to suggest some of the things that they had in common.
Well, it's interesting because in his Purple of Martin, it's hanging up by a string or a small rope.
Yes.
And that was actually very common in Udry's paintings. We have one in the Worcester Art Museum here.
I know you do. And you were going back that far because he did other ones. The birds, in fact, the first birds that Audubon did in the New World when he came in 1803, and he had been studying with specimens actually in France and also taxidermied stuffed specimens, he wanted to animate his birds back to life. That was his aim really early on. And by hanging them from a string, he was looking at these, they were called trophy paintings. And they were birds, because people killed birds, they harvested birds for food, okay? And they were a part of a hunting culture. He had this martin that he hung up, and also he had a full-size barn owl that he hung up, and many other birds, because he wanted to draw them and reanimate them back to life. He hadn't quite trained himself in his eye to observe them in nature, because he drew some birds only by having seen them, not putting them up on his position board. This was the beginning before he had his position board. He wanted to show them moving and in life, but the Oudry and other artists in that trophy tradition, which you find a lot in France and also in the lowland countries, probably gave him this idea.
Well, it's amazing looking at Oudry's painting, the one here, because the species of birds are automatically identifiable. They are anatomically and plumage-wise exactly correct. There's two snipe, European snipe, in the painting, and they're identifiable as snipe. Red-legged partridge hanging up, immediately identifiable as a red-legged partridge. Now, we're gonna
we could stop and go to the museum, but we can't do that. Right?
But I want to talk about his travels to Britain. Started May 1826. Why did he head to Britain?
That is another long story. People had been urging him, actually, when he was out in the wilderness in Natchez, and he and Lucy were teaching and advertising, teaching drawing, teaching French, and tutoring people. He has been advised by people he met to go to France and to go to London because they thought that everyone knew that the publishing world sort of centered in those two places. But he actually decided he wanted to go to Philadelphia, which was, of course, the publishing and ornithological capital of the United States. Obviously, it was a place near which he had sort of entered the United States when he was at Mill Grove. And instead, he went to Philadelphia, where he really shot himself in the foot. He was a person who was obviously very insecure. He was shy. Oh, I mean, it's just laughable. And he overcame it by making himself larger than life in a context that was where it shouldn't have been. He sold himself. Much the way people sell themselves on social media today. He tried to be an influencer, boasting about all of what he did. And when he met with the members of the Academy, who, of course, were very much involved with Alexander Wilson and other people, and some of them, like Mies and Harlan, were great supporters, but other ones like George Ord, who was the sort of keeper of the flame of Wilson, and actually finished the American Ornithology, the last two volumes, when Wilson died prematurely in 1813, Audubon just did a horrible thing, a terrible faux pas. He went in and he attacked Wilson by saying, "My works are better than anybody else's," and that also included Rembrandt Peale, who was doing the illustrations for the rest of the American Ornithology. So, I mean, he really brought about his own rejection by the Academy. He wanted their stamp. He wanted to find a publisher in Philadelphia, but by his presentation, he was blackballed, basically. Later on, of course, even when Ord was alive, he was elected as a member of the Academy, but at this point he was blackballed, and he knew that he had made a terrible mistake, and he fled to New York, okay, with his tail between his legs, literally. And so he sort of regrouped himself, and then he decided he would go to London because it was the place, the center of really fine publication at that point.
Well, he's looking for an engraver, right,
of his paintings. He's looking for an engraver and someone who, that would be publishing, you see. He wasn't envisioning a book per se, but he was envisioning plates after his watercolors.
So he had 400 works, right, 400 drawings, I mean paintings.
He claims he had 400. You know, he was always prone to exaggeration, and he probably did because we know that he had more watercolors than were actually preparatory for the plates, the 435. He probably had them. We know he destroyed some of his early work.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't think measured up. But who knows how many. He had a great quantity because when he arrived in London, we know, and he actually arrived in Liverpool, that he had a large number of works. The boat actually, and And it was providential that it did, I think, because it, and I don't write this in the book, that's the wonderful thing about talking with you. I just realized that it was probably providential that he landed in Liverpool because he was able to, shall we say, acclimate himself culturally. It was a smaller environment. He was immediately picked up by a Quaker merchants who were also abolitionists, who were some of the movers and shakers of society of Liverpool. And what's interesting is, in America, Audubon had also been associated with Quakers, which is why when you read his wonderful works, and he is a great naturalist writer, he always uses, and when he writes to Lucy, his wife, he uses these and those. For his entire life, he did that. So he naturally fit into this environment. They called him simple intelligence. They sort of adopted him because he was this wild thing at this point, and he was wild.
Whoa. He really played into that, though, didn't he? I mean, he dressed up in buckskins and stuff like that because he knew that that would be sort of part of his image.
Yes, and that was slightly later. He didn't start out that way, but he was rewarded for that. So he crafted in Liverpool. He crafted this persona, and he had buckskins with him because that's what you wore when you went in, you know, in the rambles. And he created this persona called the American Woodsman. And even when, this is jumping ahead, but even later when he went to Paris, he was wearing a fur hat with a tail on the back of it.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We think of Davy Crockett. He was thrown out of the Louvre because he had this hat on. it's laughable. Anyway.
I want to talk about when he goes to Lazar's studio. That's the first time he ever witnessed the engraving process.
In process, just to go backwards, in Liverpool, and he went to Manchester and elsewhere, and he had exhibitions because he raised money by exhibiting his watercolors, because they were going to be, he hoped, produced by subscription, but he needed money. He was going to go in, and he was advised to go by a publisher to go to London. But then Manchester rejected him, where he had success in Liverpool, so he got cold feet. So he went to Edinburgh. But that was smart because that was also a great publishing center at the time, and it had the perhaps pinnacle, highest level engraver that was widely known, which was William Hulme Lazars, who was an artist in his own right. He was a pupil of Wilkie, Sir David Wilkie, and he was... engraving various ornithological projects, such as Prito John Selby's book of birds. So he went to Lazar's, and he was actually, Lazar's heard about him and invited him there. He had never seen printmaking done.
Wow.
So it was like, the veil of ignorance had opened, and he just, really realized what I think at that point he was asking. But he was always, he was networking, what we call networking. but, of course, then it was much different, and it was a smaller thing, and it was always personal. And people liked him because he was rather, he was naive, he was bumbling, and they sort of wanted to take him under their wing. And they sort of, adopted him. He was a strange American, who was so bombastic in a way, but shy in another way. And they realized his genius, I think, when they looked at things. And he actually, I don't think he was boasting. Later on, he is not so personal. But in his 1826 journal, which he ends on New Year's Eve in 1826 and sends to Lucy, it's written to try to keep in touch with her, is the really only authentic journal that you have, where he pours his soul into it because he is making himself. And you realize it's like reading a teenager trying to figure out who he is. And it's the one journal you can really depend upon because he's lonely and he's telling it basically like it is. There are some exaggerations, of course, but it's basically truthful.
Well, we're going to run out of time. He finally decides on what the project's going to be. It's going to be double elephant folio, 435 plates.
But he didn't know at the time how many. Okay, he didn't know.
But he wanted to illustrate 1,037 birds, Life size.
I know. And he started out actually.
He didn't have that work that much work done yet, did he?
He did, but he kept doing it and getting rid of the others. Originally, he had 400, but by the time he ended up, it was 432. His first prospectus is 400, but then he changed it to 432, and he knew by that time he had run out of species because, of course, there was exploration going towards the west. And, of course, he would incorporate some of those in the octavo, which is the one-eighth the size of the double elephant folio that he produced between 1840 and 1844.
Okay, talk to me about Robert Havel, Jr.
Robert Havel, Jr. was the son of Robert Havel, who was a distinguished printmaker. They had three addresses, and they worked together, except there was a falling out. And he was an old man winding up his career. After the first 10 plates in Edinburgh with Lazars, Audubon seems to have thought Lazars didn't like him and was not delivering on time. And so he was going to London anyway for more subscribers because he had to get people to sign up for his fascicles because these plates were issued in groups of five in, it turned out, 87 parts. A fascicle is a part at the birth term. And it was brilliant in a kind of packaging because in each, instead of organizing things phylogenetically or taxonomically, he organized them according to what watercolor was done, and he always had one large, one medium, and several small, so that everybody, no one knew what was coming next. It was like nature. What do you get in your backyard? What do you get in the woods? What do you get in the marsh when you go out? It's like nature. It just happens before your eyes. And this was part of the charm, but also the brilliance that he stumbled on. And he was smart to do it because he knew at that point that there were new birds being discovered. He knew he couldn't do it all at once. He knew he couldn't wait till the end. He wouldn't live to see it. And his subscribers would die off, and they might go bankrupt. So it was a brilliant kind of scheme. So the first 10 plates were Lazars, but then he went to London, and he realized, first of all, with Havel that it was brilliant, that Havel could do it for less. And then Lazars' colorists struck, okay, so they couldn't do anything. It was also cheaper in London because you didn't have to ship the coppers, the copper plates that the engravings were done up there, nor the paper, the double elephant folio paper that had been newly invented for watercolors. And it was going to work better in London. And then he found out when Robert Havel said, no, I can't do it, I'm too old, that he was given by Kolnagis his son, ironically, who had been estranged from the father but came back into the fold. And Robert Havel, Jr. was brilliant. Not only was he a good landscapist, but he had mastered the ability to do extremely refined aquatint, not only etching, fine etchings, but aquatint, so that you could produce a print that had all the halftones between white and the paper and black, so that you would have this underlining tonality, and you would have the ability to have a depth to the watercolors that would be hand applied by colorists over this. And he could bite them as many times to get the effect he wanted to. It was a much more sophisticated kind of printing, which makes the Birds of America one of the pinnacles of early natural history illustration before lithography took over etching and engraving in the 1830s. That's what made it so brilliant. It was a major technological as well as artistic achievement. And Havel and Havel Jr., Robert Havel Jr., and Audubon got along perfectly, and I always like to use the sort of analogy that they're like two horses pulling a carriage. They were in step together, even though they had differences, and Audubon always called him Mr. Havel in all the correspondences they had. And remember that this was a long-distance project many of the times. Audubon was in London off and on, but he was also going back and forth to get more birds. It was a wonderful sort of thing. And how they organized this and how they dealt with things was through correspondence, but they didn't have email. They didn't have
any I know.
It took months, and sometimes the letters were lost because ships sunk. And the same thing happened to his marriage. Sometimes he and Lucy, their correspondence was lost for 6 months. And so they doubted each other.
Taking a boat from America to Britain takes 65 days.
It did for him, because that first trip that he made back, he was lost in the doldrums for around New Orleans for weeks. Other trips only took 3 weeks, and if you got it really fast, it would be 2.5 weeks. And all of his 6 crossings are recorded. And it's really interesting. And they also, times were very different. Different New York papers would record when the ships came in. So you can begin to trace when he came back and forth. It's very fascinating.
We're almost out of time, and we haven't...
No!
Yes!
We have but scraped the surface.
I know that.
Oh, my goodness.
And actually, I wanted to talk about him meeting Thomas Buick. Now, he's one of my bird art heroes. And we'll talk about that
too.
Another time. And I also wanted to talk about...
Redditté and...
I know. Don't
Thomas
stop.
Thomas Lawrence.
We'll do a part three.
Okay, but I love Buick, too, and they became, I think they were birds of a feather. They became very fast.
Well, Buick was much older at that time.
Much older, and again, he stopped to see Buick when he was on his way to see Selby, and the whole family adopted Audubon. Okay, this was in 1827. They adopted him. They thought he was wonderful, and Buick was also very authentic. And interestingly enough, Buick illustrated Aesop's Fables, which of course was the source for La Fontaine, for his fables. But Buick was he did the birds.
We're out of time. We're completely out of time,
oh.
Roberta.
No.
So we'll do part three.
I don't believe it.
My returning guest tonight is Roberta J.M. Olson. She's curator of drawings emerita at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College. And we've been continuing, and we will continue, our conversation about her brilliant book and beautiful book, Audubon as Artist, A New Look at the Birds of America. Roberta, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed it, Mark.
I did too. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.